Sin acknowledges and pays respect to the traditional owners of the land on which the Sin office and studios stand, the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nations. Sin also acknowledges and pays respect to the traditional owners of the lands our content reaches, as well as the radio stations we broadcast from across the country.
Welcome to Film 101, the show that looks at everything film, from the biggest new releases to awards hype to interviews with practitioners working on films, right through our film recommendations. We have a huge show lined up today, and quite possibly a show that the three of us have all been looking forward to for a while, both for the films on offer and for the general concept of the show. Those three of us are, of course, myself, Arnie, Tom, and Darcy. Thank you guys for coming in again.
Hello.
Good to be here.
It's our Netflix special today, and we'll be looking at three of the most ambitious films, I should say, in Netflix Originals history. And they are The Laundromat, Dolomite Is My Name, and The Irishman. So I think we'll jump straight into our first film of the day with The Laundromat. Directed by Steven Soderbergh, the film basically stars Gary Oldman as Jürgen Mossack, Antonio Banderas as Ramon Fonseca, Meryl Streep as Alan Martin, David Schwimmer as Matthew Quirk, Jeffrey Wright as Malchus Irvin Bonkamper, Sharon Stone as Hannah, Robert Patrick as Rick, Larry Wilmore as Jeff, James Cromwell as Joe Martin, and Will Forte and Chris Parnell as the doomed gringos. Now, the plot, according to Netflix, basically goes like this. When a widow gets swindled out of insurance money, her search for answers leads to two cunning lawyers in Panama who hide cash for the super rich. Now, what are your guys' thoughts on this film? Because I know that we've all got kind of differing opinions on it, and I think there's been a widespread spectrum rather of feedback or responses to the film, that it's, you know, either for better or for worse. So what was your guys' thoughts on it?
I'm pretty in the bag for Steven Soderbergh. I've seen basically all his movies, and probably one of my favorite directors. I think he just has the most interesting take on any subject. Like, he's made heist movies and basically made the best possible heist movie, the Ocean's trilogy. He's made Aaron Brockovich. Like, he's just made so many types of films, and now he's working with Scott Burns for a couple of movies now. Who's also just starting a movie now with The Report, which is coming out next week on Amazon.
And it's getting a wide theatrical release in Australia as well. Yeah,
which is the same sort of film. But I found this movie just really charming.
I mean, well, Darcy, unfortunately, a lot of people don't share your consensus.
Not really
I do. I just want to point that out there. I really enjoyed The Laundromat.
Well, the critical scores say 41% on Rotten Tomatoes, 6.3 on IMDb, and 57% on Metacritic. The film is obviously officially classified as rotten. According to Rotten Tomatoes,
it's official.
That's where we go to officiality. Mm. No, but I don't know. I wasn't able to connect with this on any sort of level. I found at least the performances somewhat, appealing in some sense, but at the same time, I wasn't able to get connected to the source material, to what they were discussing. I felt like there was a lot of jargon in there that just wasn't directed for me.
It's a very non-linear story, and it uses a lot of non sequiturs, because we start with Meryl Streep's character and her husband in a boating accident. And then from there, we have like an African businessman who's having an affair with his daughter's flatmate. And then we've got another story in there about other things.
It's basically an anthology movie, which doesn't really work with like an 80-minute film. What I always found really interesting is that this is a Netflix film that wasn't made into like a larger miniseries, which I felt like it was perfect for. Like Dirty Money, which has been one of the Netflix's biggest docuseries. And I feel like this story is perfect for that sort of platform.
Well, I mean, I just found that there was a lot going on here in that 80 or 90 odd minute runtime. When you've crammed so much in there and so much political subtext in there and, Kasi political commentary, it's hard to kind of invest in these characters because you're thinking about so many other things at the same time.
It's interesting you say that, though, because even though the plot took so many deviations, every single story I found myself absolutely absorbed. I was really interested in everything that was going on.
I just wanted to see more of Meryl Streep,
I think that's the kind of the issue of the movie, is that there's one section with Meryl Streep as the widow is just so much better and so much more developed, I think, than the other sequences, that you're kind of like hoping that she comes back that sort of way, yeah.
And the film is also, it was nominated for the Golden Lion for Best Film at the Venice Film Festival this year, alongside some pretty big competition as well. Do you guys feel that that's a warranted nomination, or was it
yes.
just... Are you sure, Tom?
Yes, I'm certain.
I mean, that's the, like, the Joker won that, yeah?
They did.
And then Roman Polanski won the Silver Lion. Like, it's company, sure, but I'm concerned that that's the company it has.
Yeah, he who we must not mention.
Yes.
But yes, I don't know. I just found it difficult to connect with on that sort of level, and I just felt like a film like this, because it's been getting compared to the likes of The Big Short a fair bit, and we were mentioning this prior to the show, Darcy, and you were saying that it's kind of unfairly being compared to The Big Short. I do think that someone like Adam McKay probably would have done a lot more with this film. This was almost like, I don't know whether it's the most political Soderbergh's been. Would you say so, Darcy? I know you've seen a fair bit of his films.
He's been political. Like, he's definitely had like a track record of focusing on like corruption and like how that affects people. And I think he's trying to tell an incredibly large story about global corruption in as like tight like vignettes as possible. And I think that's just incredibly hard to do. With The Big Short, is still a cohesive small story about like a couple of financiers finding out a large thing. Where basically this is like an inverted version where Gary Oldman and Antonio Banderas in incredible tuxedos are telling you what's happening.
Yeah.
And also it's multiple people who are sort of catching on to what's happening. It's not just Meryl Streep's character. I mean, everybody, it's sort of like a domino effect, really.
It's almost like a slasher movie and like everyone's finding out who the slasher is in like the end of their little bit.
Yeah.
I have to say as well, technically this film is quite interesting. I mean, I love the idiosyncratic style, but some of the things, I mean, the framing of some shots is quite awkward. Like there's one scene in which Oldman and Banderas are in the church where Meryl Streep's character basically congregates. And yeah, it's this huge wide shot from a distance framed of the three of them, and then as they walk off the scene, it slowly pans in on Meryl Streep.
I love that.
Yeah, I mean, okay. It was good, but it's like...
Well, yeah, I think that's the thing I've always been drawn to with Soderbergh, is that a lot of his content is like any other director would just make a normal version of it, but he always just has things that make it just a bit more interesting. I think the way he like films conversations are very like interesting. I think like the Coen brothers is one of the only other directors that make conversations more interesting with filmmaking.
Again, I found it quite drab at moments.
I think you would much prefer The Informant, his Matt Damon movie, which is also on Netflix.
I haven't seen. I know, I was a fan of the Ocean's films, you know, growing up. I used to watch that a fair bit, and they'd obviously be on TV and the sorts. And we spoke about one of his films earlier this year as well, High Flying Bird. So he's had a really interesting kind of career trajectory in terms of where he's gone with his films.
I just want to pick up on something that you said, Arnie, because you think this material would be handled better by Adam McKay.
That is what I mentioned, yes.
There was an Adam McKay movie earlier in the year that you and I vehemently disagreed about.
Yeah, I probably forgot to put, like, earlier Adam McKay.
One and not vice.
Yeah, that's right.
I will say Soderbergh is also making another comedy with Meryl Streep coming out next year.
Oh, isn't that great? Well, Meryl Streep, well, she's got a couple of great films coming out as well with Little Women as well. Yeah. That's going to be
break that record for Oscar nominations somehow.
I mean, hasn't she already for female...
Well, she's got to keep on breaking it.
I mean, Soderbergh's, like, has his own record with Oscars, so it's good company to have. He was the first ever to be nominated for two in the same year.
Films?
For both Best Director and two movies in the same year.
Oh,
with
God.
Aaron Brockovich and Traffic.
Right.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, there you go. He set his own benchmark. In terms of some fun facts, okay, the film is based on the non-fiction book Secrecy World, Inside the Panama Papers, Investigation of Illicit Money Networks and the Global Elite by Jake Bernstein.
Apparently it's a really good read.
Well, it exposes the world revealed by the Panama Papers, a landscape of illicit money, political corruption, and fraud on a global scale. I don't know how much of this was Soderbergh trying to set his own agenda politically. Like, I feel like he was really like ramming these political undertones in.
It's the last 5 minutes or so, really, where he gets to be the most political, I think.
Which I loved. Like, I love that whole section. I think it's an incredibly political story, I think, at a time that it kind of got forgotten pretty quickly. Like, a couple of politicians, I think, lost their jobs. I think the Icelandic prime minister went to jail over the Panama Papers.
There's a scene in here with Chinese politician Bo Xilai.
Yeah.
Being arrested for corruption. I actually remember when this happened because I was studying BCE politics at the time. And, you know, a lot of people were suggesting that this was a new era in the Chinese Communist Party, but in the end it just turned out to be a power struggle because Beaujolais was seen as the chief rival to Xi Jinping, who, as we know, has sort of gone back to the old communist ways of China.
And just a couple more facts before we sign off. Meryl Streep and Gary Oldman won Oscars for playing British Prime Ministers. Meryl for essaying Margaret Thatcher in The Iron Lady, and Gary Oldman for playing Winston Churchill in Darkest Hour. So two Oscar winners in there. Riley Keough was in talks to join the cast in what would have been her fourth collaboration with Steven Soderbergh, but she became unavailable due to scheduling conflicts with A24's Zola. Sharon Stone previously also worked with Steven Soderbergh on Mosaic. Composer David Holmes and Steven Soderbergh's eighth collaboration, obviously with Soderbergh as director. Mm. So a couple of milestones in there, and a couple of interesting connections and I guess reunions of sorts.
He also was the cinematographer and editor of this movie, which he made as pseudonyms.
Well, I think he's just at that point where he's like, I can do what I want.
Yeah,
I can do it myself. I think he's treating a lot of what he does. You're listening to the Film 101 podcast on Sin. We're going to head into our second segment, looking at basically Dolomite Is My Name, a return to form in some sense for Eddie Murphy. Now, the film basically stars Eddie Murphy as Rudy Ray Moore, the great Rudy Ray Moore, who pioneered in blaxploitation films and black cinema, in rapping.
Godfather of rap,
there you go. It's also got Keegan-Michael Key as Jerry Jones, Craig Robinson as Ben, Wesley Snipes as D'Urville, Devine Joy Randolph as Lady Reed, Mike Epps as Jimmy, Titus Burgess as Tony, Snoop Dogg as Roy, Chris Rock as Bobby Vale, Cody Smith McPhee as Nick, and Bob Odenkirk as Lawrence Woolner, basically uncredited. Mm. The plot basically centers in 1970s LA. Struggling comedian Rudy Ray Moore hits it big with his raunchy alter ego Dolomite, then risks it all to take his big act to the big screen. What are your guys' thoughts on Dolomite Is My Name?
I had a lot of fun.
It was a really fascinating movie, and this was coming from somebody who knew nothing about Dolomite or Rudy Ray Moore at all. I only saw him referenced once on Spicks and Specks with his Christmas album, and that was it.
Do you guys agree that this is a return to form for Eddie Murphy?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I've put here, and I'm probably going to go for hell for saying this, but I've said that it's Murphy's best performance since Tower Heist, which is, of course, the 2011...
It was like this decade, wasn't it?
Yeah, so it was the 2011 Brett Ratner comedy. And because what I loved about that performance was it harked back to his 80s persona, like this really energetic man who's just on top of things, but at the same time, he just can't handle the world around him. Mm. And I felt very much this performance was in the same vein. You know, Eddie Murphy as Rudy Ray Moore, it really captures the old Eddie Murphy that we know and love.
And I think you could tell that it was personal to Eddie Murphy. He was obviously so invested in this role, and he's someone that's come from a diverse background as well, an interesting background, somewhat similar to Rudy Ray Moore in the way that he's gone about his career, which I feel like he really connected with and really channeled in his portrayal of Rudy Ray Moore.
The thing with Rudy Ray is that he basically didn't become successful until his late 40s, early 50s, and Eddie Murphy broke onto Saturday Night Live at 19. Yeah.
But in terms of the stand-up comedy side, starting off there and kind of going into...
But he was doing that at 14. So Eddie Murphy's
Rudy Ray Moore is in that sense. I'm saying
and it's very a metatextual text of seeing the movie through Eddie Murphy being this man.
Well, it's kind of almost... You're almost watching it as though it's Eddie Murphy going... How his career is almost kind of going... I mean? How it's starting and where it's going. Even though it is... In that later phase of Rudy Ray Moore's life, it does share a lot of similarities with Eddie Murphy's own kind of career and how he's gone, what he's done in his career, gone from obviously stand up to films. What was the last performance you guys remember seeing from Eddie Murphy prior to this?
Tower Heist. Yeah. Oh, and he was also a lead in a movie called Mr. Church, in which he tried to take on a dramatic role, and he did okay, but the movie was pretty naff.
Okay.
Yeah.
The last one I saw with him was a film where it was something to do with a tree and the leaves were falling off, and by the time when all the leaves fall off the tree, then he kind of passes away. It's that sort of thing. It was a really emotional film. I can't remember what it's called. It's not called The Tree of Life, not to be confused with Terrence film. No, but it was to do with the tree. But anyway, I would pay to
see that remake.
I just thought,
Eddie Murphy in The Tree of Life.
Who's directing, Tom? Who's directing it? If you had to pick.
Let's go with John Landis.
John Landis. In terms of the critical scores, it's got 97% on Rotten Tomatoes, 7.4 on IMDb, and 76% on Metacritic. It seems like everyone, or most people across the board, critics and audiences, like, have recognized this film and recognized Eddie Murphy's performance in this and recognize the story and how important it is in capturing a period that was so crucial, fundamental in, you know, blaxploitation cinema and how we understand blaxploitation cinema now. Would it be fair to say that, guys? Do you think, I don't know how many blaxploitation films you guys have seen, but would it be fair to say
that? I find it interesting that the screenwriters with Larry Kazanowski and Scott Alexander, they don't come from like a rich blaxploitation background. Like, they're two white guys from the 80s. Mm. But they have, basically, they've pitched their career off of making biopics around underappreciated people. So they made the Ed Wood movie in the 90s. They made the People vs. Larry Flint and the Andy Kaufman movie Man on the Moon. And which is, so they're very different movies to Dolomite, but in the same way, they're kind of about the same sort of things.
I don't know. When it was starting off, I don't know how much of this is based on fact. The whole point of Dolomite, he takes these jokes of sorts, or these stories from these, to put it in his words, quote-unquote hobos or homeless people. He takes these kind of stories and then he reimagines them or reinvents them in his own way to perform. I don't know how much of that was him kind of taking this from these people, like these stories and that. I don't know whether that was something that was intentionally kind of just
That's the part that kind of bugged me about the movie, is like, and about his story, is that it's not real. Nothing seems authentic besides like his like driving ambition, like unrelenting hustle.
Like kind of getting success from other people. But how else do you start in an industry like that? And you can see through his character that it's difficult to kind of break through in his, and he's obviously in his later stages of his life. Like, where do I go?
And I've actually written in my notes here that Dolomite Is My Name is very much reminiscent of The Disaster Artist.
Yeah, so it's essentially the same movie. Like,
But the difference being that Rudy Ray Moore, he's someone who understands the value of friendship and collaboration. And he even says to the director, Derville, who's played by Wesley Snipes, you know, don't have an ego trip. This isn't about you. This is about all of us. So he's humble.
It makes sense in the later stages. I was just thinking in that sense, like kind of scrounging off people's success. Do you know what I mean? That sort of, or off people's who could have been successful at a point. But at the same time, who would have listened to those people? You have to be a sort of personality, like Eddie Murphy's character, like Rudy Ray Moore was. You have to be a sort of personality to bring that material to life, which he ended up obviously doing. And you mentioned Wesley Snipes here, who played Derville. What were your guys' thoughts on his performance?
He was incredible in this. Oh, he is, isn't he? Wesley Snipes so much.
Yeah, I mean, he was known as a leading action man in the 90s, but I think his true calling is comedy, because he is absolutely brilliant.
He's hilarious. A lot to do with the eyes as well.
Yeah, and just like an eyebrow move and a slight like side glance. Oh, it's incredible.
I know, I saw a video recently on Twitter. It was like a reunion between, well, it wasn't a reunion of sorts, but it was like a Will Smith and Martin Lawrence met up with Wesley Snipes and Eddie Murphy at like their films were like filming at the same studio or something, and like seeing them kind of unite together. And I was like, wait, what's Wesley Snipes in? And I'm like, surely he's not in what's the other
Bad Boys.
Yeah. I'm like, surely he's not in Bad Boys. I'm like, what's he doing with Eddie Murphy around there? But there you go. He was obviously in Dolomite.
The two of them are also filming a sequel to Coming to America.
Is that what he's in?
Yeah.
So Wesley Snipes,
he's also making a new Beverly Hills Cop movie.
Eddie Murphy is.
Yeah.
That's been in development hell for years. In fact, the fourth movie was due to be released on March 25th, 2016.
Oh, there's still time.
Which was a very dark day in cinema, because it was the same day that Batman v Superman came out. But
But they have been confirmed, those films, Tom.
So, yeah, Beverly Hills Cop 4, it will be happening at some point, but we don't know when. Coming to America, I should say, does actually have a release date. Mm. So it will be coming out next year.
Keegan-Michael Key also said he was a huge fan of Rudy Ray Moore before getting cast in this film. While working on The Predator 2018, forgetful film, the other cast members would come to his trailer to watch Moore's films. So obviously Moore had a profound impact on cinema and on black cinema as we understand it and how we see it, and with these people kind of crediting him as well. Eddie Murphy, who was also 58 years old, plays the role of Rudy Ray Moore, who was actually 47 when Dolomite 1975 was filmed. Wesley Snipes is 57 years old, but he plays the role of Derville Martin, who was 35 years old when he directed and acted in the film. So a big age kind of discrepancy there. This is also Eddie Murphy's first R-rated film since Life in 1999. Would you guys... Look, I'm sorry, I have to point this out before it slips my mind, but the sound in this film, I was having issues. I don't know whether it was just me, but hearing them over some of the music that was playing... Like especially-
a little bit, yeah, but I wonder if like that's kind of a trend in blaxploitation movies. I think especially Superfly, I think the music was so much louder than everything else going on in those sort of movies.
Like I was struggling to hear like when they were doing the stand up, when the songs would come on, when Eddie Murphy's obviously going around, like I was struggling to understand what he was saying, what some of the other people were saying. At the same time, maybe that is the case. Obviously we're of the white community. And, you know, there's a scene in there when they go into a cinema and it's like it's like all white people watching a white film.
Yeah.
And they just feel so out of place. Like what's so funny about that? Mm. Like, I don't know.
I think it's like, yeah, that was probably the most important part of the movie, I think.
It was like the turning point in some sense. I'm like, but I honestly thought that was going to go a different direction to where it ended up going, where he wanted to kind of make a film, like following that screening. Mm. Eddie Murphy, as Rudy Ray Moore, claims to have worked with Red Fox, whose comedy routine is featured in the film. Murphy, in fact, previously worked with Fox 3 decades earlier for his directorial debut, Harlem Nights. Do you guys remember that film?
Well, I was born in 94, so no.
Yeah.
Just before your time. Just before what am I saying?
Before all of our time.
It's also the most vintage Rudy Ray Moore movies. Oh, sorry. Most vintage Rudy Ray Moore scenes are recreated in their entirety with modern actors. However, in the house escape scene, and I won't say the line here, from The Human Tornado 1976, only the close-up shots of Moore were replaced. So Eddie Murphy appears to interact with the original supporting cast in the film.
Okay, I didn't even notice that.
Yeah,
that's pretty interesting.
Yeah. Although it goes unmentioned in the film, the 23-year-old director of photography for Dolmite, Nicholas Joseph von Sternberg, is indeed the son of legendary director Joseph von Sternberg. There you go.
That's pretty nice.
Did Nicholas go on to do anything in the film world?
I was looking at his filmography the other night. He was in, I think he played Nightcrawler in one of the X-Men films. I think that was him.
Okay.
From what I saw in his filmography. But yeah, I don't think he's done too many major roles. Mm. In the scene where Wesley...
Hang on, you're thinking of Cody Smith McPhee, the actor.
Yeah.
I was actually talking
about the actual person.
The real Nicholas.
Oh,
yes.
Okay, right. Yeah, no, I'm not sure.
Okay.
In that sense. No. In the scene where Wesley Snipes encourages Eddie Murphy to, quote-unquote, use it when he is acting in a scene in a similar one in Blade, Trinity 2004, where Blade tells Jessica Biel's character to use it after Natasha Lyonne's character dies. Murphy and Snipes will also, here we go, we've confirmed it here, will be reuniting with director Craig Brewer for Coming to America. Any final thoughts on Dolmite?
I hope people like actually search out a lot of the historical blaxploitation movies, especially the ones from the early 70s, so like 71 to 74. I think there's just some great content there, and like really like socially political stuff as well.
Mm. And we should also applaud Netflix for picking it up, because chances are, if it hadn't have gone to a streaming service, this would have been another one of those films which only played in African-American neighbourhoods, in the African-American theatres.
Yeah.
And people wouldn't be able to, a wider audience at least, wouldn't be able to appreciate, you know, the life and career of Rudy Ray Moore, because it's a fascinating one.
You're listening to the Film 101 podcast on Sin. We're going to head into our final segment of the day, and we've left a bit of extra time for this segment purely because there's so much to discuss with this film, and that film is Martin Scorsese's The Irishman. Now, I know that all three of us are so opinionated on this. In terms of the plot, hitman Frank Sheeran looks back at the secrets he kept as a loyal member of the Buffalino crime family in his acclaimed film from Martin Scorsese. That's according to Netflix. They've actually added that.
You've got to chuck it in at the end.
You've got to chuck in Martin Scorsese. That's the selling point.
Very, very modest they are. An acclaimed film from Martin Scorsese.
Yeah, like, acclaimed is like, that's like the bare minimum you can say about Scorsese. Do you guys think that's a fair summary from Netflix? I feel like there's so much more that happens in this film.
Okay,
it's interesting they don't mention Jimmy Hoffa in that plot.
Mm. Yeah, that's very interesting. Well, because the point they make, and it is one made in the film, is that most people our age, and even the generation above us, have no idea who Jimmy Hoffa is. They just know him as the guy who disappeared.
Did you guys know who he was?
I knew vaguely about him and like his... like connections, quote unquote, with the mafia at the 80s.
Mm, I mentioned this here on Film 101 before, but there was a joke made in a comedy film called 9 to 5 about him, and that's all I knew about him.
Yeah, well,
only that.
Yeah, well, to be honest, there's not much. Obviously, he was, according to the film and sources, he was the second at the time almost to the president in terms of like power and influence.
Yeah.
So it's ridiculous that there's not much more on him. Like, obviously, that he was quite tied in with, according to them, the mafia and the amount, you know, loans that he was giving to the mafia and the sorts, and the loans that he was stopping going to the mafia or the mob. So a lot of that was probably kept under the surface. I don't know how much of that was actually exposed at the time to kind of ruin Hoffa. Mm. And obviously, I can't say whether he's a good guy or not because we don't know. Mm. But Robert De Niro basically plays him. Al Pacino plays Jimmy Hoffa. Robert De Niro plays Frank the Irishman Shearer, and Al Pacino plays Jimmy Hoffa. Joe Pesci comes back to play Russell Bufalino. Harvey Keitel is Angelo Bruno. Ray Romano is Bill Bufalino. Bobby Cannavale is Felix Skinny Razor DiTullio. Anna Paquin is Peggy Sheeran. Jesse Plemons is Chucky O'Brien. And Stephen Graham is Anthony Provenzano. And there's a huge cast in there. A lot of people that have come from the likes of, you know, Boardwalk Empire and that show. What was that show that Scorsese did as well that he was... Oh, what was it called that he worked on?
Again, this is why we're a movie show, not a TV show.
Yeah, not a film show. But it was,
with Bobby Cannavale.
Yeah, that's right. And Ray Romano was in that as well.
Yeah.
We'll have to find out what the show was called. So, yeah, a lot of people have come from diverse backgrounds and diverse acting experience, and Scorsese gets the most out of them, and he gets the best out of them. Do you guys feel that's the case in terms of... Obviously, when you've got De Niro, Pacino, Pesci, and Keitel. That's pretty much all you need to sell a film. And with those guys, you know, not getting younger anymore, and do you feel like this is almost the capstone to their career as well as Scorsese's?
It very might well be. But we've also got to remember that Scorsese has worked with most of these cast members before, so he knows how to get the most out of them, and they know how Scorsese works. The two performances that surprised me the most were Ray Romano, because he's known mostly for his comedic roles, and Al Pacino, who just hits it out of the park. I mean, I was absolutely blown away by his performance. A lot of people were saying he was kind of hamming it up and it was quite cheesy, but I didn't get that sense at all.
But, like, I think most Pacino performances is him dial up to 11 and no one can, like, compete with him, and you basically forget there's anyone else in the room when he's performing.
I'd go so far as to say Pacino, I think everyone, you're either a Pacino guy or a De Niro guy in that sense, when you kind of compare the two. But I'd say Pacino is possibly the greatest actor of all time, in my opinion.
Ooh.
Yeah, I'd put that call. Because I was telling Darcy before, there's something about, like, in his eyes, like, when you look at him, like, you can feel the emotion before he even starts speaking. Mm. You can feel, like, the character before he even starts speaking. Because I don't know what it is. His eyes are alluring or something. I don't know.
Well, it's his whole body. He puts it on the line. There's a scene there
but
where
he's 79, mind you, and he's, like, how exuberant and, like, boisterous he is in this film is ridiculous.
Absolutely. His whole body is just moving. And there's this great scene in there where he admonishes most of his staff, and you could just see the anger in his body, the way he just grabs the chair. He's about to lunge at somebody.
Yeah, but not... See, but, like, when he's getting so riled up, and you think he's just going to, like, explode, and then he just, like, cuts it. He stops. Do you remember that point?
Like he never loses that, like, humanity.
Because he stops for, like, I don't know, it's like 5-10 seconds or something, and then just, like, paces a little bit and then comes back into that character, which is ridiculous. I don't know. Pacino, for me, was the standout in this film. Pesci, obviously, we have to talk about as well.
Pesci's ability to, like, silence a room when, like, he doesn't say anything for, like, long stretches of time. You're just completely gripped in what he's doing.
Mm. And you've mentioned, Darcy, this is while we're preparing for the show, that it's quite an understated performance because you remember Goodfellas.
He's basically doing the Pacino in Goodfellas.
Yeah, he was really, really scary. And yet in this movie, it's quite understated. You know, it's sort of like he's a very friendly guy, but you don't want to mess with him. Mm. Like, you know, as soon as you do put a foot wrong, it's like you're gone.
And if he likes you, like, that means more than anything in the world in that context.
And a lot of that I think is ingrained in the way the mobs operate. Like, obviously, when you connect with these bigger figures and how they kind of pull you under your wing, like he does here with De Niro's character. Like, he's been in minor roles here and there over the last 20 years in advertisements. He's kind of, I think there was, like, a Snickers one as well. But he's been quite out of the big picture, like the big scene. And then he's come back here, and he is playing a much more toned down version of himself. But like you mentioned, Darcy, quite commanding in the scenes that he's in. Like,
I'd argue Pacino's barely done really anything the last two decades as well. I don't know, I feel like I haven't really seen him.
He was in Jack and Jill.
Okay. I have not seen that movie.
Is that the one with Adam Sandler?
Yes, that one.
Well, he did another film with De Niro, like 2009 or something, that we're in, but that's quite forgetful. And they mentioned as well.
And he was a couple of scenes in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Yeah. So the last couple
he was too.
So it was like this year.
That was a pretty prominent role as well.
The last couple of years have been quite quite for him. But yeah, this year he's just gone, again, like in some sense, like Brad Pitt as well. He's, like obviously Brad Pitt's done a lot in the last 20 years, but like they've both kind of had this, 2019's been a real resurgence of sorts. De Niro, I have to mention, I think this might be one of his more complete performances.
I mean, it helps that the movie, like we have to mention, this movie is 210 minutes long.
Yeah, it's
like,
really
like, long. There's a lot of time to have a 12 arc, like character arc going on.
And I rewatched it today as well. So that's what, 7 hours in, hours of Scorsese in the last week or 5 days. But De Niro, because you're with him almost the whole time, he's narrating the film as well. He's narrating as well as, you know, acting in the film. And he's also much more reserved, but I feel like he's played a fair bit of reserved characters in the past, really isolated to themself figures. And obviously we can go on for days, you know, from Taxi Driver to Raging Bull.
I think the power of De Niro is when he's like, he's that reserved for so long, but you know that there's like any moment he could snap. And you're always just like slightly unsettled about him in every scene.
And I have to ask you guys, what did you think about the CG in this film? Because there's been a lot of talk about the de-aging process.
That cost them like $100 million and is basically the reason it had to get to Netflix.
Well, I know the film was on like a budget of initially of $100 million and went up to like $160, $170 million by the end.
Yes, absolutely. Now, it's not the worst de-aging effects I've ever seen. Like, I think Aquaman is probably like the most awful de-aging effects I've ever seen in a movie. But there are times when it's particularly noticeable. I mean, we're de-aging De Niro by 30, 40, even 50 years in some points. And during those earlier scenes in the movie, it's quite evident that they have de-aged him. Like, particularly when they're trying to capture the character from a distance.
But yeah, because I think you can de-age someone's face, like, quite... I think that's most of that is done quite well. I think they try and do that as often as possible.
Yeah, I mean, if you're watching it on a big cinema screen, as we did, and as you can do around Australia for the next 3 weeks, then it does become troublesome. But if you're just watching at home on a laptop or a tablet or something like that, it's not really that much of an issue.
There is a bit of... I noticed, especially the second time around, like, I noticed it a bit in my first initial viewing, but the second time, like, there's a bit of, like, stuttering. If you look at the mouth... Like, it doesn't... Like, I know Scorsese's mentioned it's the eyes that were the most important to get right.
Yeah.
Because that's where the emotion comes from.
I reckon that's the problem with the movie, though. It's the eyes. They don't look very realistic. They look to be the most...
Because they've got, like, that slight CG, like, glean over the whole face. Yeah.
They look quite glossy, at least De Niro did at the start when they were in the truck.
So I do wonder, like, how this will actually look on, like, a laptop or a phone screen, where it'll, like... It's incredibly upsetting to Scorsese that's where people are going to watch this movie.
But that's probably where that's the de-aging and those effects are going to make more sense, because when it's on a big screen, it's so much more bloated and inflated.
I felt that the de-aging worked the least when it was shot from, like you were saying, from a distance, because you can de-age someone's face, but you can't make a 75-year-old act like they're 35 when they're fighting someone.
Yeah.
And that's where it kind of fell apart, I think.
I know they mentioned, people have been writing as well, that you can still see the kind of contortion of sorts in the movements and the restrictions
A 75-year-old still looks like a 75-year-old.
Yeah.
But I think it's so important to the movie that it is the same group of people that we're watching for 40 years. And I think, like, narratively, it still works incredibly well.
But I think they could have achieved much the same using makeup. There is a part of me...
That's what they wanted to do, because they wanted to make this movie 10 years ago. And I think that's when it would have been possible.
Yeah. But I think there are certain scenes where the CGI does hold up. Like, you see it in the trailer as well. There's this 360 shot of where it, you know, moves around De Niro's face as he's on a phone call to Jimmy Hoffa. And then those scenes look great, but there are other times where it's kind of like,
Well, I have to admit, it looks even more odd because the film is shot in 35mm.
So it's kind of conflicting with those kind of two
you've
things.
You've got those two different aesthetic choices kind of, you know, meeting each other and how that's... And obviously, De Niro's also got the contact lenses in his eyes, those blue contacts. So I don't know how much... I don't know. I feel like that would have been really difficult to achieve, at least with his de-aging, because he is the most de-aged in this film. And I've mentioned the 35mm. What did you guys think? I think it's fitting for this film. I don't know. I can't imagine...
It looks beautiful throughout. Yeah.
I can't imagine a gangster Scorsese film without it being shot on film, at least on 35. Like, it looks insanely good. The runtime, we've obviously mentioned, it can be here and there. I think that's where the appeal is going to come from Netflix, because you can sit down and actually pause it and watch it.
Yeah, I kind of want to know, like, I know Netflix doesn't, like, give out statistics, but I kind of just want to know who watches it all the way through and who cuts it over two nights.
Like, it's particularly slow and drawn out in parts of the movie, but I think during the third act of the movie, the last 45 minutes there, that's when the runtime makes sense all
yeah,
of a sudden.
It feels so earned and justified. Yeah.
Like after that whole journey, you're finally reaching that, I guess, pinnacle. That,
the climax.
Yeah. I think it's the longest sequence of events of a Scorsese movie where there isn't music, which is something you just don't notice in a Scorsese movie until it's not there.
And we were mentioning absence of sound, of visual elements, of narrative elements. It's really important in this film. Absence in itself is important.
There is so much to this movie. It is incredibly good.
It's hard to talk about it in 15-odd minutes. I mean, in terms of critical scores, it's received 96% on Rotten Tomatoes, 8.6 on IMDb, and 95% on Metacritic.
There are some people who are even calling this the best Scorsese film ever, which is a bold call. This is the same man who made Goodfellas, who made Casino, who made Raging Bull.
This is such a good 2019 for Scorsese. He's made this movie. He executive produced The Souvenir, which is one of the best critically loved movies this year. Mm. And he also made the Bob Dylan Netflix movie, which is probably in my top five of the year.
I think people forget how much Scorsese has actually done. Mm. Do you know what I mean? And with those early films, obviously they were instrumental in how they shaped cinema, and obviously New Hollywood and moving into that period. This is almost like a kind of callback to that period and a celebration of the genre of the gangster genre and the figures and himself almost. It's all about calling back, and he's mentioned as well. It's a self-reflexive film.
And it's definitely harshly critiquing, I think, the gangster genre and how much that's been idolized. And I think he's kind of calling attention to that and kind of pulling it apart. Same way Unforgiven did with the Clint Eastwood movie in the 90s with westerns.
One of my fellow presenters on Arts Written, Michael, he mentioned in his written review that whereas other movies, Tarantino, for instance, in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, the blood flows freely, in a Scorsese movie, it's just little squirts.
Yeah, and it's so much more impactful.
Mm, absolutely.
Yeah. And I think when you're saying that it kind of critiques almost the genre, he's added the extra layer of family, and that is really important in these mobster films, but the relationship between Peggy and Frank and the likes of Jimmy and
Jimmy's Russell. Wife.
But I feel obviously Peggy was the most important female character here in terms of how she kind of really impacted the characters of these mobsters in different ways, and her presence was, or her longing for a paternal
presence.
Especially
the younger actress before Anna Paquin plays her. I think she was incredible. Without ever saying anything in this movie,
But it's how she almost bridges these characters together, and like we said, the emotional value, when you stay towards the end and those last 45 minutes, they're the most gratifying because of how much you know that relationship was so important, and how it kind of informed everything that came after, and how it affected Frank in his later life, and these people the longing for family and the actual importance of family beyond just saying say hello to your dad for me or things like that. Do you know what I mean? The actual family dynamics in the mob that happened that we don't see too often, that we haven't seen too often in these older mobster films. The film is also won Best Feature at the Chicago International Film Festival, which was presented to Scorsese. An excerpt from the festival statement says, "This award marks the first presented to Martin Scorsese from the Chicago International Film Festival. The festival, which launched Scorsese's film career in 1967, was also where the late Roger Ebert first saw his film, a pivotal moment for them both."
Yeah, they were close friends.
He would have loved this movie.
He would, absolutely.
The Golden Trail Awards, they also won Best Motion Title Graphics for Netflix and Open Road, and Best Graphics in a TV Spot. And at the Hollywood Film Awards more recently, it won Supporting Actor of the Year for Al Pacino, Visual Effects of the Year for Pablo Hellman, and Producer of the Year for Emma Tillinger-Koskoff. Do you guys see this film going up for big Oscar awards?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, provided there isn't the same anti-Netflix stance that we saw from the Academy last year.
I think that has to be gone. I think that there's three or four large Netflix movies that are going to compete this year.
Mm. So, yeah, I think it stands with a big chance in the acting categories, also direction, screenplay.
Best picture.
Definitely best picture.
All the actors.
Production design, potentially visual effects.
Yeah, I'd be interested to see if visual effects for the de-aging gets it.
This is ridiculous. there's going to be a lot of Netflix films up for nominations this year. And we haven't even seen Marriage Story yet. And, The King has obviously sweeped up a heap of nominations at the ACT Awards.
Yes.
So that's probably going to be Netflix's favour as well. That Academy will probably recognise that, even though I don't think it was the greatest of films. But what I'm saying is, Netflix, they've really got their foot in with these critically acclaimed directors and just great original films that you don't see too much in the big multiplexes because of the, and Scorsese mentioned it, the theater films, the
The blockbuster fair, superhero movies.
The roller coasters.
The roller coaster films. Mm. Yeah, that's right. So it's a good platform, and it's good to see Netflix endorsing these films. We've got a heap of statistics here, but I just don't think we can get through them all.
We won't be able to.
Right
now.
No. You're listening to the Film 101 podcast on Sin. You've been listening to Film 101 on Sin today. Thank you, Tom and Darcy, for joining me in the studio to talk about The Laundromat. Dolomite is my name, and Scorsese is the Irishman in our Netflix special.
Mm. Yeah, it's great.
It's been absolutely wonderful. We should devote another episode to The Irishman, I think, because there's just so much to unpack.
The second half of The Irishman we can do.
Yeah. We could do a Once Upon a Time in Hollywood Mick versus almost The Irishman kind of we can see how that kind of fares up. But yeah, we'll be back on next week again, same time, 5 p.m. to 6 p.m. on 90.7, I'll give a little teaser here. We'll be talking about one of the films will be Marriage Story, another Netflix film that we haven't been able to include on our show today because of the
currently
time of
the highest rated movie of the year.
That's ridiculous. Yeah. So yeah, a huge film that we'll be discussing next week. Tom, where can you find us?
Yes, you can find us on facebook.com/film101syn. We're on Twitter as well, at film101syn. And we've got an email address now as well, so you can contact us via film101syn@gmail.com. And don't forget, you can also listen to us on the Sin website on omni.fm. And we're also on digital radio as well, just like the good old days.
Indeed. Till next week.
Bye-bye.
See ya.